always been a...
Gadget guy.
Would you say I'm a gadget guy?
Dr. Gadget.
We're talking with Marjorie Sushaki, and just for a moment pretend that I am from Mars, and this man from Mars knows nothing about you or nutrition or food or anything. So if you would begin by telling me a little bit about who you are, where we are, what you do, and we'll go from there.
Well, my name is Marjorie Sushaki, and I'm a registered dietitian. I'm also an assistant professor at St. Louis University in the Department of Nutrition and Dietetics. We are in the cafeteria at St. Louis University, the Doisy College of Health Sciences. And the reason that I really wanted to bring you down here is that we're currently operating the cafeteria here, and I find this a much more comfortable place than in my messy office right now.
Okay.
But,
well, I never mind being around food. Tell me a little about how you got into this field.
Actually, I was in a different field before I came into nutrition. I was in clothing and textiles and merchandising. And in my third year, I actually saw someone that was in the industry, and I changed my mind and decided I was really more people-oriented. And so I looked at two possibilities either horticulture or in nutrition. And I actually have been cooking since I was probably 9 years old when my mother got ill. And then when I was in high school working at a grocery store, someone told me, take those plums home and make some jelly. And I took the plums home and bought the sure gel and made my first batch of jelly when I was 15. Then the peach tree fell over in the backyard and I made peach butter. And so it just kind of goes on. And then I got my grandmother's canner. And I learned how to can when I was in college before I was actually in nutrition and dietetics. So it was a natural transition to go into nutrition.
So you were starting out with fruits and veggies and right in line with the new pyramid.
Very much.
What do you think of the way people are eating these days? Is there a big difference between the ideal and the real, what people would need to be eating for good health and what they actually are eating?
I think we value good nutrition. I think that what we really see is that there's a discrepancy in what we value and what we actually do. And that a lot of people have the knowledge of what they should be eating, but the practicality and the reality is that they're not quite meeting that. And
why is that?
I think that because people value good nutrition and they are sometimes misinformed eaters, so that what you have happening is that they'll go down a path that they think that this is a healthy thing because someone mentioned it on television or in the media in some form, and that they give it a try because they're going to do what they believe would maybe be the easier way to make sure that you're really healthy, and so that we give in to those types of things that if there's a simple solution and I don't have to think about it too much, you know, if I don't have to put a lot of effort into it and it comes easy, then I might try that road. And I think that's what we see a lot of people doing. It takes time to eat healthy, time that sometimes people's priorities are different. And so good nutrition doesn't quite come up there.
Why are there so many books out there that promote this diet or that food source? Carbohydrates are good one year, they're bad the next. Low fat, high fat. My son's a doctor, and he says that people are eating low fat and they have fewer heart attacks, but they're having more strokes because the brain likes fat. What is it that's driving us? We all want to be healthy, but is it lifestyle that's keeping us, our busy lifestyle keeping us from eating healthy? What do you think is going on in our culture?
Oh, well, number one, why are there so many books out there is because it's a market system that we have. And so if you have something to say and you think others will buy into it, you're going to write your book and sell it. That's not new. But we always have to try to put a new flair into what we're writing and what people are reading because that's what drives the market. You have to find a different niche to be able to attract people's attention to buy your book. So really, for the most part, what we've seen happen is the cycles go around and around. So it goes way back, I mean, way back in our history of how people believe what is nutritious or healthy for us. And then what we start finding as the science comes in, it starts to change. But then science also changes, and that confuses people. So I think as soon as a new book comes out, they believe that, well, here's the newest information, I'm going to buy it, and I'm going to try to follow it. If I can make the rules black and white that you can follow, it's easier for you to follow, but it's very restrictive. I would say that probably in the 80s is when we wanted everyone to know what their cholesterol number was, that a lot of health professionals, not just dietitians or physicians, got on the bandwagon that we have to have low fat. And it was very interesting because before that it actually was low cholesterol. So when I first started practicing, we would tell people it's okay to eat fried fish as long as you fry it in peanut oil or safflower oil or a low be a polyunsaturated fat, which was supposed to be heart healthy at that time. And it's funny that we finally get to the point that we realize it's the total amount of fat in the diet that has the biggest impact, but it doesn't mean that there should be no fat in the diet. We need a certain amount. It helps with various things, like gives you satiety, that you feel satisfied after a meal. It enhances flavors, and so when you use herbs and spices, those flavors meld with the oil and they spread over everything. It coats all the food and it gives you a wonderful flavor. And then the third thing is you need a little bit of fat in each one of your meals so that you can absorb the fat-soluble vitamins. So, you know, people are afraid of fat, I think. We've developed this fat phobia, and I think your son has a point where we do need to have some fat in the diet, especially the monounsaturated fats. But I wouldn't just zero into that, because I think that constantly what we see, nutrition is a new science, a relatively new science. We didn't have all the vitamins identified until the 1940s. So, you know, we're only 50 years down the road, well, 60 years down the road. And if you go back to other sciences, you go back to Galileo. So things have developed rather rapidly with nutrition, and we keep fine-tuning. We never paid attention to phytochemicals before, and now we're paying attention to phytochemicals.
That's in the fruits and veggies?
Fruits and vegetables. The phytochemicals are the colors, the pigments, for the most part, that you associate with a colorful diet. So one of the recommendations is choose your foods by the colors of the rainbow and try to have all the colors of the rainbow in your food selection, especially for produce.
Is that a particular diet that's promoting color, or is that
sure? There's a diet book that's out there on it. but I think what you really have to do is carry the key messages.
And
the key messages are lower your total amount of fat. Make sure you have heart-healthy fat in your diet.
And that means no trans fats?
Trans fats are the hot issue right now. Trans fats exist in nature in some of the foods that we eat, but we also create it by making partially hydrogenated fats that we can use and put them in products that give them shelf life. That's one of the reasons that we went to it, because a fat that's polyunsaturated, heart healthy, it has, when you get to the chemical makeup of it, it has these double bonds. And anyone that remembers chemistry, you can break one of those double bonds. It takes a lot of energy, but you can break it. And so what you have is one of the things that we talked about is free radicals can attack those double bonds and they can break it in a polyunsaturated fat. That's what lines the, I always talk about it in reference to kids, because when little kids are born, they need some saturated fat in their diet. And that saturated fat helps lay down the myelin sheath on their brain, on each of the brain cells. So the myelin sheath helps to protect the brain cell, okay? And the polyunsaturated fats, as we get along, polyunsaturated fats are in the little cell membranes around each one of our cells. And it can be attacked by those free radicals just by breathing oxygen, by some of the foods that you take in. Having too much iron in your diet can actually attack those
those double bonds and break them down. And when that happens, then the cell membrane could be compromised,
so
weakened.
So we need fats, and we need...
You need color.
Color.
You need color
because
in your fruits and
the...
vegetables because
okay.
antioxidants, the phytochemicals, and so we talk always before about antioxidants would be vitamin A, vitamin C, vitamin E.
And they they help to prevent heart disease.
They help
Where do
prevent,
you get those from?
You get those from, I would say, first off, whole grains, fruits, and vegetables.
If you don't eat the vegetables, can you get that from a vitamin pill?
I would prefer not to do supplements as my first line of defense. So I look for food, and I try to get people to work with food first. Because supplements, a lot of times people will take a supplement to compensate poor dietary choices. And you don't know everything about what's really in the food, and that's what we're finding out. If you pick your produce by colors, you're increasing the antioxidants, the phytochemicals from the colors, the pigments in the food, and you actually may have some other compound that's present in the food that when we extrapolate and we just get the phytochemical or the vitamin E or vitamin A or vitamin C, then we don't have those other compounds.
So you're
and
saying
so
you
we
can't
don't know
assimilate
enough.
Food?
We don't know enough about what is it that's within the food that makes it so healthful for
us. So the
us.
Body can use it.
So that the body,
assimilate.
Well, it's not. It may be that so that the body can use it, but there's just interactions. It's chemistry. So there's interactions between compounds, and so it's better from a dietitian's point of view to eat the food. And then if you want to take a multivitamin, don't take a supercharged vitamin. And for men, probably not taking a vitamin that has added iron. You're not losing blood unless you've had some kind of an accident. You don't need extra iron more than what you consume each day.
What's the problem with iron?
Iron, it seeks to bind with another electron that would be provided by the cell membrane or other components in the body that lets it hook up and settle down. Because to be used by the body, iron is actually going to have three charges to it, and it seeks to eliminate those positive charges by hooking up with electrons.
So it's
too,
not
much
good
iron,
to have too much iron.
Well, what happens is you store it as a man, and as a, if I were a postpartum, excuse me, not postpartum, but postmenopausal woman, we don't lose the iron through blood loss. And so what happens is you start having to store extra iron someplace. And there is a disease called hemochromatosis, which your son will know about, which is excess iron storage. And so you have to be able to get that out of the body, and sometimes people will have to have that particular disease treated, but it also raises your risk for heart disease. So
you accumulate that naturally in most foods that you eat.
Yeah, you
not through a supplement.
Generally, unless you're vegetarian, a strict vegetarian, then you would not be at risk of iron deficiency.
What if you have a strong distaste for
What do you
green
have
vegetable?
A strong distaste for?
Just about anything green.
So what about
Except
yellow?
Yellow,
like yellow, red, other things? What you really need to do, a dietitian really would want a patient or a client to approach dietary change with an open mind, to be willing to try things. And actually, and a lot of times it's sometimes the way foods were prepared, and does it go back to how it was prepared when you were a kid versus today?
In other words, if you grew up with canned green vegetables, you might not like green beans.
Or if your parents actually forced you to eat certain foods.
Spinach.
So you don't have to have spinach.
I know, and I can eat it mixed into things.
Well, that's exactly what we
and
would do.
And that's okay.
Yeah.
You don't have to just eat it.
Oh, no.
Boiled. Or
now, see, I prefer things kind of more plain, but I also like combinations. And if I'm cooking for someone, I do all kinds of combinations. And so it's a lot of fun to do that. And if you just slip a little bit of that in, you usually are not going to be overwhelmed, and you're not, because spinach and some of the other green vegetables have strong flavors, a lot of people don't like them. Some people are what we call super tasters, and so those strong vegetables like broccoli and
Brussels sprouts.
Very strong. And so super tasters react to that more strongly than someone who's not a super taster.
And they can just be prepared differently.
Just prepare them different ways or put just a small amount in. My husband and I have to count out our Brussels sprouts when we eat them. We cut it half and half. You get half, I get half. Don't get one more than me. But, you know, everyone's different. But there are ways that you can do either combinations, small amounts of the food that you don't have great affinity for, but combined with other vegetables or with other flavors, you might find that you like them.
What would you say is...
Oh, yeah.
So what would you say is a way to approach food in a busy culture where I think seven or eight meals are consumed a week by most people at restaurants, fast food restaurants or what have you? What would you say to them who say, well, I don't have time to cook or prepare or think about meals, I'll just grab and run? And what would you say they need to do to really make sure they're getting all of the foods in the food groups?
I actually would look at where are the Chef's Express kinds of counters in grocery stores, whether it's Whole Foods or if it's at Schnucks or Dierbergs or any of the other grocery stores that you find today, that if you can go to the counter where they have things that are ready to go, they present them very well. And so they usually will combine them with, they may not have huge servings of vegetables, but they have some on the side. That's one of the things that we do at our cafeteria. When the students come in, they get maybe a wrap or a piece of pizza, but they don't just have pizza. They get a salad served on the side. So our intent is to have a small amount of salad or fruit or vegetable with their meal when they are served.
Now, I know the new pyramid suggests that we should have more than five a day of fruits and vegetables. It's what now, 7 to 11?
It's actually probably 8 to 9. And it goes in line with something called the DASH diet. And the DASH diet is something that's called, it was a program or a research program called Dietary Approaches to Stopping Hypertension. What they found was people not only reduced their blood pressure, but some of them were starting to lose weight because they were eating more fruits and vegetables. They got certain minerals that were deficient in their diet, and they were consuming skim milk products, low-fat milk products, and they were using a little bit of nuts, and they weren't eating huge amounts of protein foods, meats. Mm-hmm. And people started to actually lose some weight, and their blood pressures came down, and it really is a consistent message that we try to send anyway. So when they incorporated or revised the food guide pyramid, they incorporated that approach. So
this is based on the food pyramid?
The two now are kind of paired together, and they go along with the dietary guidelines for healthy Americans. The DASH diet was something that the research was supporting and saying that there's good things about this. DASH diet, Mediterranean diet, look very much alike.
They do.
Yes.
You're talking about fruits and vegetables?
Fruits and vegetables.
If you have fruit that has been canned or more fresh than out of a can,
mm-hmm.
Is that good? Or do you have to eat them right out of the bin, unpeeled?
There have been studies that have been done because a lot of people think that all you can have is fresh. But you can use canned, you can use frozen, and you can use fresh.
It doesn't lose nutritional value?
Because what happens is, once you buy it, what happens to it when it gets home? Are you storing it right for it to maintain all of its vitamins and minerals and to keep the essential good nutrition level as it was when it came out of the field? How long has it been hanging around in its fresh state? And so how are you storing it? How are you preparing it before you eat it? Has an impact. If you have something that's canned and you eat it, just heat it and eat it, you've got the, that is canned in such a short period of time after harvest that it's at its peak nutrition when it's canned.
Really?
If it's frozen, it's the same thing. Peak nutrition at the time that it's picked and frozen. But you can always overcook. You can always do something in your way of preparing that food that will diminish the nutritional value. Now, I personally prefer fresh. And I don't care if you buy it fresh and you cook it, or if you buy it fresh and you eat it raw. There are times when cooking actually enhances your body's ability to use it. Because you can't just eat everything raw and expect your body to break it all down. It's going to pass kind of through your system.
Mm-hmm. Because so if I go to the orchard and they put a bottle of pears and they've skinned the pears, they've taken the skin off of it, that's still just as nutritional as...
does not have as much fiber in the pears as if you left the skin on it. But there's actually, there's only going to be about 2 grams of fiber in a serving of pears anyway. That's just a ballpark figure, and it can vary a little bit. But that fiber that is in the skin is the type of fiber that's insoluble, and there's good things about having the skin on your fruits that you would want to do. But it doesn't significantly increase the amount of fiber. If you want to get high fiber, you go after whole grains. You'll look for the brands. You increase your consumption of fruits and vegetables, and you eat dry beans.
Dry?
Navy beans, black beans. Dry beans is a whole category. Okay, so not the hard dry bean, but cooked dried beans. And cooked dried beans are an excellent way for you to get your fiber in. It's just not a way that a lot of Americans choose to eat their fiber, because I think personally that there's some connotation. Number one, I think a lot of people don't know how to cook beans that have great flavor. And then secondly, I think it's associated with poor, low income, times of the Depression. You know, if you had to grow up eating beans, you weren't wanting to eat beans when you, if you grew up in the Depression and now you're in affluence, you don't want to eat beans. But they're good for you, and there are ways that, just because our body doesn't like beans initially when we eat them and we have some problems with gas or distension, that is only because you haven't been incorporating them into your diet anyway. And after a period of time, the type of carbohydrate that's in that bean, your body's enzymes will start being able to function again and be able to eat the beans without that much of a problem.
Have you got any suggestions for how you can cook beans to avoid the gas problem?
Well, there's you know, a couple of things. You can use Beano drops or Beano tablets, and they are supposed to help you reduce the amount of gas. There's also an herb that is called epazote. Epazote, and it's an herb that in Mexico they'll use when they cook their beans. And it gives flavor to the beans, but it also is supposed to help reduce the flatulence. People will soak beans, and that's supposed to help to release some of the...
Soak them overnight.
Soak them overnight before you cook them. That's another thing. But for the
most
part...
Water. Yeah.
Pour off the water and then cook them in your recipe as you would.
So the new diet recommendations have at the bottom or along the side this exercise. So exercise and fruits and vegetables are at the bottom, and with grains. And what would you say about exercise? How much is the recommended amount of exercise? Most of us are sedentary Americans. Mm-hmm. We're overweight. Yeah. Obesity is a raging problem. What is the recommended amount of exercise?
Nutrition and physical activity go hand in hand for good health. So that's the message first off. And then since 1996, the Surgeon General of the United States has made the declaration that most Americans should get physical activity up to 30 minutes every day or on most days of the week.
This is aerobic?
Aerobic or any type of activity, but primarily aerobic, because aerobic is what gives you a healthy heart. It raises your heart rate. It uses the muscles of the body, and so it actually will help you to burn calories. But resistance or strength training is another good thing, and flexibility. So we can't forget about all of it. But especially we're looking at that aerobic activity. Get your heart beating harder, make you breathe harder, and then you know that you're in that zone that's good for your heart.
And this is 30 days, 30 minutes a day, most days
of the week.
That's
most
ambiguous.
Most days of the week. Well, it gives us that possibility that you have a population that has not been exercising. Okay, so it gives you that flexibility that people can do it 5 days a week or six or seven.
Or if we do exercise, we get in the car to go to the gym.
Right. And you know what? Like you did, ride your bike. You can walk and you can take flights of stairs. I mean, there's all types of ways to get your exercise, and you don't have to go for 30 minutes all at once. For people that have a very busy lifestyle, 10 minutes, 10 minutes, 10 minutes.
And that's as useful as doing
it
all at
once?
You
know, it doesn't get your heart rate up for that that length of time, but if it's more than what you were doing, we're doing better. And that's the approach that we really need to be taking if we want to send a message that people are going to accept,
right,
is that they start thinking of how can they fit physical activity into their day, and how do we actually send messages in our environment that encourage physical activity rather than encouraging sedentariness.
Where are you with things like salt? I know sugar and alcohol and these kinds of things are ambiguous, and they're on the side that, you know, of course some people cannot have any alcohol, but the recommended is perhaps a glass of wine a day. My son says a glass of wine a day is helpful. Two glasses a day is neutral. More than two glasses a day, forget it.
More than two glasses a day of alcohol, you're going to see rise in actually problems with high blood pressure for some people, and with your increased risk for cancer, certain types of cancers. But women are not recommended to consume two servings a day. They're recommended for no more than one.
Okay.
And that's because men and women are different in size and muscle mass. But with sodium, we're talking about 2,400 milligrams of sodium each day. That's the recommendations. Most Americans are consuming between 6,000 and 10,000 milligrams a day. So we've got a long ways to go with that. And
what's
not
that doing?
Is that in our food? Is that why
it's in? It's in your food. It's there a lot of times as part of the, it's again this whole aspect of, I'm going to prepare a product that I can put on the store shelf that you can come in and buy, and it's still going to be safe to eat. It's in the preservatives, okay? So then it's also in how we prepare foods in fast food restaurants, that if we're going to tenderize some of our meats so that it's nice and tender when you get a chicken breast sandwich, that's going to have sodium in it. I found it rather interesting to buy frozen chicken breasts, boneless, skinless chicken breasts, have higher sodium content than I thought they should. Right. And I thought they were just the fresh meat itself that was frozen. But it is treated in some way that there's sodium in it, and it's higher than I really expected it would be. It's not like me getting a chicken and cutting the breast off and pounding it and then freezing it myself. So sodium comes from primarily the processed foods that we consume. When people are trying to reduce their sodium intake, they take the salt shaker off the table. That's not as big of an impact as changing how you're eating, what kinds of foods you're eating. And it's a dilemma. We're eating out, they're going to be sodium. And so,
and fats, because
yeah,
these things taste good.
Exactly.
And sugar. So we've got three of the five. I remember an old joke that goes, the five basic food groups are alcohol, salt, sugar, fats, and nicotine,
like,
right? So we've got three of the five. So talk about sugar. What's wrong with sugar?
You know, you can have sugar in your diet, but it's with moderation.
And it's in apples and fruits.
It's there naturally, and it's in milk. It's a milk sugar. It's in your grains. It's the carbohydrate that you eat. But simple processed table sugar is not going to bring with it other nutrients in high amounts.
It does funny things to the pancreas.
But so does, if you eat a white potato just by itself, your blood sugar is going to go up. Uh-huh. What we really need to understand is that sugar is helping us to creep up our calories across the board. How many sodas do you drink a day? How many spoons of sugar go into our coffee or tea?
How many spoons of sugar go into a soda?
I once 150 calories, and you divide that, there should be about, is it 40 teaspoons?
No way.
Yeah.
Into one soda pop?
Divide 150 by 4, and or by 5, so that's 30 teaspoons. And that's in a 12-ounce can, not your 20.
I haven't drank a Coke for a long time. Well, I drink one once a month. Gosh, I'm glad I cut
that's
that
why
out.
It's really interesting that we're coming up with these combinations where you have a little bit of sugar and a little bit of sweetener, artificial sweetener like C2 Coke. I don't think it's going to stay in the market, but it's interesting.
So, in a nutshell, being extremely brief, what does one do? I'm hurrying. I'm in a fast-paced lifestyle. I've got my cell phone on, and I'm running from one thing to the next. And what do I need to eat? What do I grab? How do I eat? How do I work in the pyramid and all of that in my lifestyle so I'm eating fairly decently?
Actually, I would concentrate on my evening meal, because if I can set my breakfast and my lunch, most people are kind of creatures of habit. Breakfast and lunch is not a dilemma. We could actually prepare that. They're not a dilemma for us to decide what to eat. So if you make a conscious effort to make sure that your breakfast and your lunch are sort of pre-programmed, then it's not hard to get those in. Where your dilemma will come is, what am I going to eat for my evening meal?
So breakfast might be cereal, a piece of fruit, and maybe a glass of milk and tea, and you're off and on
your way. Sure, or it's as simple as a peanut butter and bread and a glass of milk and out the door. Or some dry cereal in a bag. I mean, I know people are busy, and you got to figure what are the fast ways. I don't think that grabbing a granola bar every day is the best thing to do.
Too much sugar?
It's high sugar. High sugar, whether it's table sugar, brown sugar, or honey, it's all the same. But having something where you've got a set pattern for breakfast and lunch that you don't have to worry about, and then concentrate on your evening meal. Find your protein source. It doesn't have to be huge. It's really 1/4 of your plate. And you have your starch, whether it's bread or potatoes of some type, or rice or noodles, the other 1/4, and then 1/2 of your plate for your vegetables and fruit. And if you can use that approach, when I go out to eat, I want to make sure that I have, you know, the option to add an additional vegetable, or instead of French fries, can I have a baked potato to start being the conscientious consumer? The market wants to please you. If you start asking for these things, they'll come up with alternatives for you. When you're looking at the dessert menu, ask about what kinds of fresh fruit or berries they have, and have a special coffee if you want to with your evening meal, so that you're still part of that social interaction, but you're still making healthy choices. And the big thing, I think, is for people not to beat themselves up when you do have a splurge. Just enjoy it. Always remember that we're human beings. We have to make these choices every day. We are not programmed machines. And so we have to live with fluxes. You know, we go up and we go down. Don't beat ourselves up about it. And just move on and get back at it the next day. One meal doesn't make or break you. And so many times we do that. I call it a light bulb mentality sometimes. You know, I'm on, I'm off. And it's not black and white. It's really gray. And that's how we need to, we try to do the best we can do. And we just keep working one day at a time, one step at a time, at getting healthier. And I think it's become a real problem in the United States. We have, not only in the United States, but worldwide, an epidemic of obesity. The Americans are really looked at as being the fattest people in the world, but there are other countries that are having the same kinds of problems that we're having. it may be the whole fact that we're moving to more an urban culture. You know, we're moving out of the country and into the city. And let's say that you have enough money to move out of the city and into the country. Well, now you're driving 2 miles, 2 hours a day to get to your work and back. That's 2 hours that you had to use to spend on food prep and exercise or physical activity, and now you don't have it, and how are you going to fit it in? Mm-hmm. So that's what we're dealing with, is we're getting all this congestion, or we're trying to do this the sprawl, the urban sprawl, that those who have money, who could live out there, but they still have to commute back into their job. Yeah. So we don't live and work and play all in the same location anymore. We rely on transportation, and that sets a dilemma for us. Now I have to make choices. Am I going to eat and drive? Am I going to eat and be on a cell phone? Am I going to drive and be on a cell phone? Or am I going to drive and exercise at the same time? I don't think I can do that. Unless you're on your bicycle.
Thank you so much. We've been talking with Marjorie Sawicki, St. Louis University. Thank you.
So I put